This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Did you know that the distance between Boston, Massachusetts and Atlanta, Georgia is roughly 1,100 miles? But if you ask EPA Administrators David Cash and Daniel Blackman, I think they might say that the distance might as well be zero. Because that's because when it comes to fighting climate change and protecting the environment, they might argue that it is just as much about regional efforts as it is about local ones. And for this year's Earth Week, that holistic approach has brought Daniel Blackman to Boston for today and tomorrow to listen and learn and collaborate. Now, both David Cash, who is the EPA Administrator for Region 1 here in New England, and Daniel Blackman, the EPA Administrator for Region 4, which also represents southern states like North and South Carolina, Florida, and Kentucky, they're both here in Studio 2. To talk more with us about that. David Cash, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And Daniel Blackman, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be here, especially since I was born in Boston, so I'm excited.
Oh, you were?
Yes,
ma'am. Where in Boston?
In Dorchester. So, I mean, I've got family in Roxbury, Mattapan, and good to be home, far away from my current home, but happy to be back in Boston.
Okay, well, that blows my whole first question, which was like, how are you finding Boston?
Depends if you ask me after my aunts cook for me tonight. But
what are they cooking, do you know?
Well, I have Caribbean family, so they're from Barbados. I'm not going to ask. I'm just going to comply and show up.
There you go. Fantastic. Well, welcome home.
Thank you.
So it's great to have the two of you together. What made you decide to come together here in Boston during Earth Week? And David Cash, I'll start with you. Did you put out an invitation? How did this happen?
Yeah, so Administrator Blackman and I have been talking about this for months. There's, as you noted at the beginning, our regional efforts are trying to tackle some of the most important environmental and climate justice problems that we have today, leveraging incredible resources that we've gotten from Congress on the order of $110 billion to lift up low-income, disadvantaged communities and right wrongs that have persisted for decades. And we have a lot to learn from one another. There's so much I can learn from what Administrator Blackman and his staff do in the southern states, and I'm hoping it's the same this way. And it's just this is a celebratory week. There's so much that the Biden and Harris administration is doing to advance these causes. It's a time for us to both celebrate and learn from one another.
So let's pick up on two of those threads. Daniel Blackman, what are two of the wrongs that are most important to try to right with that money?
Well, I think first and foremost, the bipartisan infrastructure law is very adamant about what's considered as Justice 40, making sure underserved communities are prioritized, communities that have been left out of that conversation. And too often, not just in our region, but around the country, we have so many communities that have been left out of that conversation, out of the investment, out of the, you know, seat at the table. And one of the reasons I'm here with Dr. Cash is to make sure that we, one, learn from each other's regions, but two, we build an infrastructure that will last well beyond our service, the United States Environmental Protection Agency. But uniquely, in Region 4, 56% of the nation's historically black colleges are in those areas. And we have some very historic opportunities since the announcement with EPA of the Office of Environmental Justice and External Civil Rights. So I think our uniqueness to the southern states in the U.S. and the civil rights impact, the disparities, but what Dr. Cash just mentioned about the investments behind environmental justice and infrastructure, it's absolutely critical for both of us to be here, to be on the same page, but to make sure our regions learn from each other.
So, David Cash, we've heard this word infrastructure three or four times now. I was going to say no pun intended, but now that it's occurred to me, I will say pun intended. Get concrete about what infrastructure you're talking about. What are we talking about when we say infrastructure?
Yeah,
here?
So there are a wide range of things to right these wrongs. And all you need to do is look at some of the data where black children are two times more likely than white children to have asthma, that a quarter of black and Hispanic Americans live within 3 miles of a Superfund site. So the investments that we're going to make are things like getting out lead pipes. We know that lead pipes are also in these same communities. So there's billions of dollars in the bipartisan infrastructure law. And the goal of the Biden-Harris administration is to get all those lead pipes out in the next 10 years. Huge and ambitious. But when you think about when you're a parent turning on the tap and you're worried what your kid is drinking, that's not the country that we want to be in. So that's one of the kind of infrastructure investments, but we could talk about electric vehicles and electric charging and ductless mini splits if you want to get technical to bring cool air and warm air to people's homes much cheaper, solar, wind, all of those kinds of things are infrastructure that we're going to be investing in.
So do pick another one, Daniel Blackman, and I'll note, just because I enjoy it when themes run through, we're going to talk about electricity in the second part of this show. Mm-hmm. Clean water is going to come up in the third part of this show, so it's going to run all through. But pick another piece of infrastructure, Daniel Blackman, that in your region, Region 4, is another piece that you're counting on or feels particularly necessary to you.
Well, as a, you know, obviously I'm an adult now, but as a child, I grew up with asthma. And the fact that 25 million children depend on school buses each and every day, we have $5 billion committed through the Clean School Bus Program, where we are literally converting our diesel emission buses to clean school buses. That is a game changer. When the fact that schools in these districts can have an impact that I think is extraordinarily important for us to protect the lungs of our most vulnerable populations, it's critical. When you look at during the pandemic, most black and brown communities suffered adversely after COVID because of pre-existing respiratory illnesses. So when you think of black and brown communities, when you think of poor communities, rural, regardless of race, these communities have been unfortunately impacted. And I'll give you a really quick example. In the state of Georgia, we have 181 school districts. 141 of those school districts have populations of 25% or higher of children that live at or below the poverty line. So when you think of the amount of school districts that are impacted already by poverty that can now benefit from clean school buses in states like Georgia and South Carolina and Alabama and states around the country, quite frankly, we're really excited about that because we allow fleets of entire school districts to get to upgrade their buses and to build a more clean and resilient future, not just for our society, not just for our democracy, but for our children. And our most valuable assets, I think we would all agree, are our children and our grandchildren and those individuals in our communities that they play with. Outside of that, there's a lot of issues we'll touch on today, but I think the Clean School Bus Program and really making our funding accessible. David and I will talk a lot about funding from EPA, a lot about resources, but we have to make sure that there are pipelines and accessibility that don't leave people out of those resources and out of those conversations.
We're having a conversation with two regional EPA administrators here in Studio 2 on Radio Boston. We have David Cash, who is ours here for Region 1 in New England, and visiting us is Daniel Blackman, who's the EPA administrator for Region 4 in the South. So I'm going to pick up on this asthma thread a little bit. A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about the Health Equity Compact here mm-hmm. in Massachusetts. Springfield, we were talking about a state representative from Springfield, which has one of the highest asthma rates here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. David Cash, early in this conversation, you said, I think we have a lot to learn mm-hmm. from Daniel Blackman, from, you know, the Region 4. This is a place where we see some commonality, right? Mm-hmm. So in this hunger, in this moment to learn, what are the questions you're asking? You know, again, I'll come back to this concrete example. What are some of the key questions that regional administrators can ask each other in this moment? We're talking incredible amounts of money on the table. It's going to get spent. It can get spent well or not, yeah. right? So what do you ask?
Yeah, so one of the questions is what Regional Administrator Blackman and his team bring to the table that I'm really interested in learning more about is there's a long, long history out of the Atlanta office in engaging with communities, environmental justice communities, which, you know, you can argue that the environmental justice movement started in the South as a kind of offshoot of the civil rights movement. And there's a lot for us to learn in how to engage communities. You know, we're a federal agency, and we don't have a lot of practice in that. There's certainly folks on our team who've been doing that for years, but we need to ramp this up to a degree that has never happened before. And so we want to learn how to do that because, as the regional administrator said, there's so much funding coming out, and we have to figure out how to bring the communities on board, raise their capacity so they can even apply for federal funding. I mean, it's a complicated business. And so that's one of the suite of things that I want to learn from him and his team.
What about reverse questions, Daniel Blackman?
Same thing. I think that, you know, first of all, what you should know is that Dr. Cash and I have a great relationship outside of our work. So it's easy to be here and it's easy to learn from him. I think for us, more than anything else, is really taking on those questions that hit the hardest as it relates to economic disparity, race disparity. You know, this administration has not been afraid of the DEI a question. You know, when we think of diversity, equity, and inclusion, we're not here to check the box. So we want to learn regionally what's working and where can we be better. I am very proud of our boss, Administrator Michael Regan, in launching the Journey to Justice in Region 4. The Journey to Justice was basically an opportunity for our administrator and the regional administrators in these respective areas to go out and go into the communities. So while it's great to be in this room, it's great to be in our offices, Dr. Cash and I are on the road and we're out. I mean, as a matter of fact, we just left his office and he has a map that has little flags of all the areas he's been to. And I think the best word I can use for us is accountability. What we want to learn being in Boston is how has progress been made? What are some of the hurdles that exist? And quite frankly, what are you doing right? Because look, let's be honest, there are 10 EPA regions. Every region is unique. They're not going to be completely the same. But the audiences that we engage, the conversations that we have, whether they are EPA friendly or they're adversarial, we have to do a better job of being accountable and working with the community. And that includes bringing them to the table each and every day. And if they're doing something right here in Dr. Cash's region that's working, we want to replicate it and not reinvent the wheel.
So many questions I could ask. I want to leave just a minute to talk about Earth Day and Earth Week. But David Cash, before we do that, one thing that is on my mind is the concentrated focus that our new governor here in Massachusetts, Maura Healey, has put on creating an infrastructure in the state to be competitive for receiving and executing on federal dollars.
Exactly.
What role does that play in both the learning environment that the two of you are talking about and in this idea of being able to apply for, get, and execute well on big amounts of money that are coming in?
A huge amount. So, for example, it was just announced recently that each state would be getting, if they choose, a block grant of $3 million to do climate planning. And once the states have done that, that'll open the door to another $4.5 billion, billion with a B, that comes from the Inflation Reduction Act. Obviously, states are going to know their economy, their electric grid, their transportation systems better than we ever will. So there's a long, long history in partnering with the states, whether it's on the regulatory or enforcement side. And here we're going to do so much partnering on the investment side. You know, they're going to know, the states are going to know where the districts are that have the highest level of asthma. They're going to know the districts that have worked as partners. They're going to know the districts that have not worked as partners in the past that we're trying to target. So, you know, there's a transformative moment where this money is going to assist with the partnerships that we have with states so we can invest, as you said earlier, to have the, you know, the most effectiveness that we possibly can to have the biggest impact in these communities. And there's another piece about this, because it's not just about reducing asthma. It's about the benefits of the clean energy future, which are also jobs. And if we think about the IT boom and the pharma boom, those all bypassed these low-income and disadvantaged communities. This time we have an opportunity to get it right. So we're talking about workforce development where students in these same schools that Administrator Blackmon is talking about are going to learn how to maintain school buses, are going to learn how to install the new kind of infrastructure for the future. So lots of benefits working with the states in that regard.
All right, last question to you, Daniel Blackmon. The best way to do justice to, I mean, our first Earth Day 53 years ago this week. Best way to do justice to it now?
I think listening to understand and not just to respond. Going into communities and letting them know that they are fundamentally a part of this conversation. Too often, and you know, really quickly to touch on what you just asked, Dr. Cash, the relationships that we have with our states, our local and federal partners are absolutely critical. That's why making sure we prioritize those conversations are critical. And when you think of where we are with Earth Day, there's a lot of distrust, right? And one thing that I think that this administration has recognized is, you know, we're going to acknowledge areas that we need to improve upon. And the Biden-Harris administration, along with our offices in D.C., with EPA, have committed us to being in rooms that are not always the easiest rooms. I think when I think of Earth Day, I don't think of a region, I don't think of a city, I don't think of a community or a specific culture. I think of a whole of government and whole of community approach to making sure that we set the next generation up in communities that have been, again, left behind, disadvantaged, or underserved. Building the capacity for a bigger tent makes it a lot easier for us to not only celebrate Earth Day, but make measurable progress.
All right. Daniel Blackmon is the EPA Administrator for Region 4 in the South, but son of Dorchester. And David Cash is EPA Administrator for Region 1 here in New England. Thanks to both of you
for being here. Thank you so much.
And now a bit of a preview.
I'm Darryl C. Murphy, and you're listening to The Common. In case you haven't heard, it's Earth Week. And to celebrate, we're going to be doing something a little different. Each day this week, we'll bring you a different story from around Greater Boston about how climate change is already being felt across the region.
And we want to find out more about that now. So here to give us a preview of that coverage, Darryl C. Murphy. Hey there, Darryl.
Hey.
Thanks for joining us. The major theme or focus overall coverage, climate change, already in progress. We just heard a little bit about what's happening around the EPA there. Why did you want to do a week on it this week?
Well, to be honest, we wanted to do some kind of series, and our producer, Caitlin Harrop, suggested that we go around the city and see how climate change is impacting the different neighborhoods, and so here we are.
So tell us a little bit about what we can expect.
Well, let's see. Monday, we had our show about microgrids in Chinatown. Yesterday, we had a show about erosion in the Boston Harbor Islands. And today we have our show is airing about Crane Ledge Woods. There's a fight to preserve a big parcel of land that's apparently the largest unprotected urban wild in the city. And then tomorrow we're going to be talking about heat through the lens of the South End, you know, being that Boston itself is a heat island. We're going to be talking about certain areas of the city that get hotter than others. And then Friday we are going to close it out with some Earth Week activities.
So what's the story that you are most excited for people to hear, Darryl?
Oh, man. They're all really good and eye-opening. I think for me, the story that I found really interesting was the Boston Harbor Islands. Just being out, we boarded a boat, and we went out there with researchers and experts and a park ranger, and we looked at all these different islands to see how rising sea levels and stronger storms and these big storm surges are leading to erosion of these islands that really like kind of protect us from big waves crashing into Boston, right, and other communities in the area. So that was really eye opening and just being really in it, right? On the water. We saw seals and stuff like that. It was cool. You know, it was such a cool day, but very, very enlightening for me.
I actually kind of feel like I can smell it, see it, yep, hear it just from you talking about it.
Yep. It was awesome.
So is there any story or topic that you want to cover in the future that came out of your reporting from this week?
Yes. Right now, like I said, tomorrow we have a show coming out about extreme heat. Being that Boston gets very hot in the summer, you know, particularly during heat waves. And, you know, there's parts of the city like Chinatown. We're focused on the South End, but like there's that whole section of the city that's just so developed with little green space and tree canopy and stuff like that. So it gets really, really hot in a city that's already hot, you know?
Yep.
And so I am interested to do more reporting on how that impacts people, because heat is serious, man. It will take you out, literally, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of communities that are quote unquote vulnerable, you know, and who to heat, you know? So I really would like to do more to get those experiences.
All right, Darryl, tell us where people can find and listen to the Commons coverage of Earth Week this week.
Well, you can go to WBUR.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. Darryl C. Murphy, host of WBUR's The Common, and just for the record, awesome colleague. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
If you think that maybe you've been paying too much on your utility bill lately, MIT's Chris Knittle says, actually, you're right. And it's not just because Massachusetts residents pay the third highest electric rates in the country and saw massive rate hikes by providers like National Grid this past winter. It's because of the pricing model itself. And those costs may be limiting our ability to reach the state's lofty clean energy and climate goals. So what do we do about that? Well, Chris Knittle is a professor of applied economics at MIT's Sloan School of Management, and he's also the deputy director of the MIT Energy Initiative, joins us here in the the studio this morning, along with Brenda Loya, who is the Chief Operating Officer for Blue Hub Capital, a community development nonprofit based out of Roxbury that makes investments in clean energy and healthcare. You're Chief Operating Officer of Blue Hub Capital. That's right. So, Brenda, welcome.
Thank you.
And Chris Knittle, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's great to have you. So, Chris, I'm going to start with you because a few weeks ago you wrote an op-ed in the Globe about electricity pricing. You did it after looking at your own electric bill, which is a very reasonable thing to do. And there, so first, I want to make sure I understand this. What should happen is there are two parts of the bill, right? There's the amount of electricity you use. That varies based on how much electricity you use. And so those costs should go up and down. And then the second part of the bill is what it costs to get it to us. And as I understand it, that basically should be fixed. That doesn't change. And so if it's working right, variability in how much you use, fixed cost that you get charged on what it takes to get it to you, but that's not what's happening.
That's exactly right. So the way we price electricity currently is we take those infrastructure costs, which are largely fixed, like you said, and instead of charging a fixed charge to the customer, we divide by how much electricity they're using and add that to the volumetric rate, it's known as.
Okay.
And so what that does is it artificially inflates that volumetric rate. And that makes electrification hard. It makes it more expensive. It makes running your heat pump more expensive, charging your electric vehicle more expensive. So as we, as a Commonwealth, want to move toward electrification, it's a big headwind that's really going to push against our climate goals.
So let me make sure I understand this. So let's say, and I'm going to oversimplify this. Let's say, you know, in 1 month, I use 100 of electricity. I pay for the 100 of electricity, but the amount that I pay to get that to me, I pay based on using 100 of electricity.
That's exactly right.
And then the next month, I use 200 of electricity. I pay the 200 on the amount, but I also pay more for getting it to me because I used 200 of electricity.
That's exactly right. So if you were to install a heat pump, you would likely move from 100 to 200, and that would be a huge disincentive to invest in that heat pump.
So let's break those pieces down because I think they both matter for not only our ability to move to, you know, cleaner ways of using energy, et cetera, but, and this is why we brought you into the conversation as well, Brenda Loya, but also because as with so many things, when we price something unfairly or inefficiently, those who can least afford to bear it often wind up bearing it most. So, A, we do pay the third highest electricity rates, and we did experience a huge rate hike, and our most vulnerable got hit the hardest, yes?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Blue Hub Capital really sits at the intersection of, you know, policy, regulation, and working with community organizations on the ground. So we hear very much the feedback while at the same time we're understanding what's happening in some of the rate hikes and how it's impacting low-income and environmental justice communities. So our focus in solar in the last 15, 20 years has really been to stabilize costs and reduce the impact to low-income communities so that they do not experience all the ups and downs of delivering and having to take on more energy. So we have been really thinking about that in the last couple of years, especially as we're getting ready for a new energy economy and how is that going to really impact communities. And that really stems from our work in financing community facilities for social service organizations, as well as financing affordable housing projects. So we've learned what it takes to develop some of these specific infrastructure projects in different communities and have had to think very creatively to ensure that some of this impact is not being passed on to community impacted, underserved communities. So that's really where we're at.
Okay, so this is where I want to start to unpack this. So now we've got the passing on of impact, and there's two things. There is how much it costs for the part that should go up and down, which is how much you use. And we know that we're working on that. So, for example, the Massachusetts state legislature has been trying to bring the rates back down. Here's State Senator John Barrett, who's among those who have been writing to the Department of Utilities asking them to reassess their energy rates.
I don't see why they couldn't. Why couldn't the utilities come in and say, yes, the market's dropped? The oil market's dropped. The energy costs have dropped to somewhat. Why don't we give our customers a break?
And National Grid is expected to decrease its supply rates by almost 60% starting in May, which would save the average customer about $115. But then we have this other thing, right, which is trying long-term to make some changes. So, for example, Governor Healey is aiming for 100% clean energy in the Commonwealth by 2030, pledging 1 million electric vehicles and heat pumps by 2030. So let's get into this heat pump space, right? So if I understand, Chris Knittel, what you're saying is, all right, so an electric heat pump should be more efficient, but we're going to lose some of what it would save us if I'm paying more than I should for the delivery because I'm not capturing the efficiency. Am I using the right words there?
Exactly. So a heat pump is actually about 3 times more efficient than a natural gas furnace. But because of the mispricing of electricity, it's more expensive to run a heat pump than it is a natural gas furnace. So even if you gave me a heat pump for free, if I still have my furnace in my house, I'm going to want to run that instead. So there's no incentive to adopt the heat pump. And even if I've already adopted it, there's no incentive to run it.
Yeah. All right. So let me ask you 2 policy follow-up questions on that, and then I'm going to come back to you, Brenda. So the first is, I am assuming then that if I am paying for natural gas to heat, the pricing is not the same, where I pay based on usage for the part that should be fixed. Is that correct?
It's not as bad. There is some volumetric rates that shouldn't be there in natural gas, but it's not nearly as bad as electricity. For my bill, which the Globe was kind enough to publish, mm-hmm. More than half of my bill is paying for transmission and distribution.
Which it should not be.
Exactly.
And how much smaller, roughly, percentage-wise, would it be if we were pricing based on the real price of what it costs an electric company to actually get the electricity to your house?
Well, certainly on average, it would be about the same. So we would what we would do is replace that volumetric rate with the connection charge.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would advocate for and encourage the DPU to look at is to have different connection charges based on income or based on zip code so that we're protecting the at-risk communities that are feeling the burden of the higher natural gas prices and higher electricity energy prices more generally.
So what you're saying is, listen, it's not that I want one flat rate for everyone because then once again, those who could afford it the least would be eating a lot of costs still. You're saying, hey, let's do it by zip code or by income so that still, if you can afford it more, you're paying more of that distribution. But it's not this wildly volatile thing that shouldn't be that everyone is experiencing. Is that correct?
It's even a little worse.
Okay.
So think about how we pay for the transmission and distribution.
Yep.
If I put solar panels on my roof, I no longer pay for any of the transmission and distribution, even though I'm using it.
Everyone else is having to foot that cost.
Exactly.
All right. So let's go back to Brenda Loya here. And we are talking to Chris Knittel of MIT and Brenda Loya of Blue Hub Capital about sort of a bad pricing model in electricity that's actually, it seems, going to make it harder for us to reach our clean energy goals and what we can do about it. So, Brenda, with these structural sort of disincentives in place, how does that affect what you are trying to do in the investments you're making in Blue Hub Capital for infrastructure for cleaner energy and more affordability for low-income communities, for social service agencies that serve low-income communities, et cetera?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think, the last 20 years, we've been looking at different policies, not only in the clean energy space, but also around affordable housing and other areas of focus. So what we try to do is really roll up our sleeves, because the communities that we're serving and the communities that we're working with are often overwhelmed, and maybe they themselves are not sure how to process and implement these changes. So we work with a number of CDCs.
Community development corporations.
Exactly. Thank you. As well as affordable housing developers. And we ourselves educate ourselves, but also engage communities, because already there is quite a bit of knowledge within those organizations and within those communities of how they can adapt. Because from their perspective, perspective, they're really thinking about their own bottom line. How do they serve more, individuals, either in healthcare centers or at community food banks? Like, how do we address these issues? So from an organization like us, ourselves as a community development financial institution, what we think about is how do we blend all of this information? How do we process and bring others to the table so that when we're going to communities, we listen, we learn, and we also educate, but also ensure that we're coming up with a solution that helps the community at large. So that's kind of what we tend to do. We were created primarily as an entity that is meant to kind of solve some of market inefficiencies that don't always serve low-income communities.
All right, so now we've got a minute left, Chris Knittle. We now know what the issue is, why it's an issue. We hear the stakes from Brenda. Have you gotten a response from the Department of Public Utilities? What have you heard in response to your op-ed?
I've had good feedback from policymakers, not the DPU specifically, but not only policymakers in Massachusetts, but even in Washington, D.C. has reached out. And California is going through a very similar challenge at the moment. So I am always eager to engage in a conversation with policymakers. I think this is doable. It's going to take structural changes, but we know that this is the efficient path forward.
And you're hopeful that it can get done.
Well, in some ways, it has to get done given our climate goals.
And in a word, Brenda, would it be a big deal if it did get done?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that we know that utilities take a long time to change and transition. So from our perspective, it would be transformational.
All right. Brenda Loya is Chief Operating Officer for the Roxbury-based community organization Blue Hub Capital, and Chris Knittle is Deputy Director of the MIT Energy Initiative and a professor there. It was his op-ed in the Boston Globe that brought us to this conversation. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Boston Celtics signed Malcolm Brogdon last offseason to be the missing piece on a team that wants to win a championship. And so far, he's delivered. He's played key minutes off the bench and shown a knack for making clutch plays. Take, for example, last night in a first-round playoff game against the Atlanta Hawks. At the very end of the first quarter, Celtics guard Derek White slaps the ball away from a Hawks player, gets it to Brogdon. The clock's running out, so Brogdon pulls up from the Leprechaun logo at half court and shoots.
Oh, yeah! What a super! Brogdon sees it the whole time, takes his time, lets it fly, and the bank is open.
That sound from NBC Sports Boston. On-court heroics, though, are just one part of Malcolm Brogdon's impact. Throughout his career, he has been an outspoken advocate for criminal justice reform and other equity issues. Malcolm Brogdon carries a spirit of leadership inherited from his grandfather, John Hurst Adams, who was a leader in the civil rights movement who studied at Boston University's School of Theology alongside Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. When we spoke with Malcolm Brogdon a few days ago, that's where we began, with his grandfather's legacy.
People see all the, I think a lot of the stories now about how he marched with Dr. King and all the amazing things he did out in the public's eye. But to me, he was just my grandfather. And for so long, until he passed, I didn't really understand his greatness. When you have such a great figure in your family, that's sort of the patriarch of the family, a lot of the time you don't see what amazing impact they're having on the world around you and how they've really shaped the world for you to really step into in an easier way than they did. And that was my grandfather. And when he passed, since he's been gone, I've actually done more research. I've actually gotten more intrigued on who he was and his impact and what he stood for. And he truly was an amazing man and, you know, did amazing things during a very tumultuous time.
Do you feel like you have stepped in or starting to step into his greatness now? Do you feel challenged, like that's what you've got to strive for the rest of your life? I mean, now that he's passed, how does that greatness sit in front of you or sit with you?
I think it's different. I think that was his path. I think I have my own path. I think, you know, at this point, I'm in the NBA. This is where I'll really build my wealth, build my connections, build my platform. To shed light on, you know, whatever I choose to shed light on. And a big piece of that is going to be criminal justice reform, civil rights issues, areas that really impact the Black and Brown community. So there, I think there definitely will be some huge overlap between my grandfather's legacy and mine going forward.
It's my perception, but it might not be true. It's my perception that while prior to 2020, you were already speaking out on issues, you were talking about racial justice, you were stepping forward in this legacy of community and service, that summer of 2020, after the murder of George Floyd, it felt like you kicked it into a different gear. Is that true, or is that my perception?
I definitely was speaking out before, like you mentioned. And I think once the murder of George Floyd occurred, I think I just had more opportunity to speak out. As far as me saying I need to ramp it up, it wasn't really that type of thinking. It was more so, here's an opportunity. People are bringing me more opportunities to speak out, to speak up, to shed light on my thoughts and the things that I care about. So I really just accepted the opportunities, and that way I had more of a platform.
You've talked about basketball as your chance to build your wealth, build your platform, the things that you're going to talk about. Let's look at 2020 as the intersection of those things. You have more invitations, you have more opportunities. It's a summer of a different level of reckoning and wakening among those who weren't paying attention before, not among everybody, but among those who weren't paying attention before. Did your priorities shift among criminal justice, racial equality, and had basketball, the investments you'd made in playing pro basketball as that platform, paid off in the ways that you wanted them to for activism and community service when that moment came?
I definitely think my not priorities shifted, but I think I did double down. I think before 2020, before COVID, before the George Floyd murder, I think this country, people in this country understood the importance of criminal justice reform, of the issues around police brutality, all these things that were going on. But when that happened in conjunction with COVID, I think it sort of heightened people's awareness and the attention and focus that was put towards those things. And that was the same for me as well. I knew these were issues beforehand, but in this moment, they were magnified. The stage for them was far greater, far bigger. So I definitely did put, for me, more focus on it, and it did make me want to double down on it more and really sort of narrow my focus in on those issues. And I think basketball, has really given me the platform and the influence, because I always tell people this. I'm no expert on criminal justice reform nor civil rights issues or these issues of police brutality, but I'm someone that cares. I'm a man that has influence because of the job that I have, because of the amount of money that I make. I think that makes people care about what you think. And when you have people's ears, I think you have a choice of to speak out or not. And I don't think there's a fault on anyone that doesn't speak out. But my path and who I am and my background is, I'm far more in tune with speaking out and trying to have an impact with my voice.
We're speaking with Malcolm Brogdon of the Boston Celtics as we get to know him here on Radio Boston. You say that you're no expert, and yet you completed a master's degree in public policy at UVA while you were playing basketball there. You were raised essentially on the campus of Morehouse, where your mom's a senior administrator, three lawyers in your family, a family deeply rooted in service and activism and commitment. I've wondered, was basketball always the plan?
No, basketball was not. Having good grades in the classroom, not excellent, but having good grades in the classroom and getting an excellent education in college was the plan. And then however that unfolded was your destiny. Basketball was always the extracurricular that I put all my focus and all my hard work outside of education into. And then, it got to a certain point where I ended up getting scholarships, and it actually helped me get a better college education. It really worked out. I ended up deciding between Harvard, Virginia, Vanderbilt, a few great schools, and it allowed me to, really pick between. There was no loss there. So I ended up going to University of Virginia, getting a stellar education, and at the same time getting my public policy degree and excelling on the court and allowing me to go to the NBA. So it definitely all, I think, happened in conjunction and helped one another.
What lit you up most in the classroom? All that studying you did, what did you love most?
As I went through my first 3 years, I wasn't sure what I really wanted to focus on. I wasn't sure how I wanted to make an impact in the world. I knew from my early travels in childhood that I would want to make an impact on Africa, on people that are less fortunate, on people that don't have clean water, or people that don't have food, that don't have shoes on their feet, that were just less fortunate than I am. But I didn't know what specifically. And once I got into my master's program, you know, master's programs are built so that you have a very narrow focus on one thing. You can leave and you know sort of what field you're going to step into. And that's what it did for me. It allowed me to focus on clean water. It allowed me to sort of enhance my vision, make me more decisive on really what I wanted to focus on. And that was clean water for me. That was the way I wanted to help make an impact overseas, specifically in Africa. That policy was the way I knew I could make a difference in that. You know, I think policy is really what creates dramatic, systematic change in this world. And then specifically clean water would be the way I wanted to affect that.
So then I got to know how it must have felt. So now you've got the Brogdon Family Foundation, and you in March spoke before the UN General Assembly advocating on clean water. So to have that light you up in college and to be one of the few people in the world who gets to go that far in being able to talk to world leaders and public leaders and influence them, how did that feel?
It was exhilarating. You know, there's so many amazing things that happened, that have happened in my basketball career, winning Rookie of the Year my first year, playing on a team that made the Eastern Conference Finals. I mean, there's so many stages in your NBA career that can be really amazing. But my visit to the UN was so different, and it was in the area of my life that I feel is my passion. Basketball has never been my passion. Basketball has been something that I loved, that I enjoyed growing up, playing with friends and really getting better at every day. I enjoyed the grind. I've enjoyed the grind. I still do. But my passion is helping people. That's the long-term, you know, overarching legacy goal. And the UN was a giant step in that direction. So I found that honestly way more gratifying than anything I've, you know, experienced on the court. You know, being able to speak in front of world leaders is such a privilege because of the game you play. So there's an appreciation for what basketball has brought me, but there's also a perspective of this is far more important. And this is far more exciting and fulfilling in a way.
I do have to ask, what do you love about the grind?
I love getting better incrementally. So I always tell people this: when you have a workout one day, when you're on the court, you have a skill session. You shoot a lot of shots, and being able to say, I came in today, I made, you know, 150 out of 250 shots, and then you come in the next day and you make 151 out of 250. That's the incremental change. That's the way you feel yourself getting better. It's the grind. You don't take leaps and jumps every day when you're working out, but it's the incremental being dedicated to your craft that actually creates the character, that actually molds you, that actually when you win a championship or you win an award, those are the days you're thinking about, because that's where you really are winning the award day after day. It's not at the end when people see the finished product.
So we had been at the UN. I'm going to stay at this narrower focus of the court and the city here in Boston for a minute now. I want to talk about Boston. You know, you grew up a lot of time on basically the Morehouse campus in Atlanta. You've played pro basketball in Milwaukee and Indianapolis. Now you're here in Boston. What has your experience been like in this city as a public leader, as a Black man, as a basketball player? What has it been like here?
I've honestly had a great experience in Boston. You know, you hear that Boston is a predominantly white city, can tend to be racist. You hear a lot when you're not from Boston, but you move there. And my experience in Boston has been good. Not to say that those things aren't going on, but honestly, when you're a Celtic, you're put up on a pedestal, even as a Black man, you're put up on a pedestal, and people don't treat you like the rest of the population. And I've had it. People have really embraced me. I've continued to be outspoken, and there hasn't been backlash on that. I think it is a progressive city. I think I've been embraced in a lot of ways. And then basketball wise, the organization has embraced me and allowed me to be myself, which I really appreciate.
Let's stay with basketball just a minute longer. So you come to the Celtics. So 2017, you're rookie of the year. Before you come to the Celtics, you're a starting point guard for the Indiana Pacers. You're not starting here at the Celtics, but you were brought here to be the missing piece of a puzzle in a team that wants to win the NBA championship. How do you see your role on this team? And do you like your role on this team?
You know, I see my role on this team as being a starter that comes off the bench to fill any holes that that are needed on any given night. And I feel like I have done that up to this point, and I have enjoyed the role. This has been a role that's been the most challenging role of my career. I went from a role in Milwaukee where I started, I played, you know, with Giannis and Chris Middleton. I played with great players, but I started but played a smaller role, but started on the floor, which is a great position to be in. Then I moved to Indiana, where I'm a first and second option. Me and Domas Sabonis are really the two leading the charge there. A lot more pressure, a lot more eyes on you, a different level of having to carry the weight in Indiana. And then I go to Boston, where it's a completely different role than both, and I'm coming off the bench and having to really learn a completely new role on a team, and it's on an excellent team. So you're learning on the fly. This is a team that made it to the finals last year, so it's a well-oiled machine that you're basically plugged in, and you have to play and pick up everything. You're drinking through a fire hose. So it's definitely been a challenge for me, mentally, physically, all of it. But then at the same time, you're playing with great players. This is the most talented team I've played with. So in a lot of ways, it makes the game easier for you when you step on the court. But it's more than anything, this adjustment to Boston has been a mental challenge for me. It's mentally changing the way you view yourself. It's having to humble yourself. It's having to check your ego, but also have enough ego and enough confidence to get on the floor and compete, still play at a high level and help this team do what we need to do.
You've said you love basketball, but it's not your passion. Changing the world, leaving it better for the world and for your children, that's the passion. So what's the dream when you're not playing basketball anymore? What do you want to be next?
I've thought about this. This is something, a question, a topic in my head that I think is very fluid. I think it changes by the month, by the year. As I meet new people and have new experiences and see the world change in front of me, I think right now I know I want to travel with my family and make sure that my kids see everything in this world that I can show them. I'm not going to be able to show them everything, but I want to show them as many cultures, as many countries, as many different types of people and different types of ways of living so that they can live a life of, I think, of service, of gratitude, and of perspective. That's my number one goal after I'm done playing. I think I will continue to work and do something that is fulfilling with my time and that I can continue to help people. I definitely will continue with my foundation, and that will continue to grow. But I, you know, my priorities are my kids and, you know, showing them as much of this world that I can.
Malcolm Brogdon of the Boston Celtics, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.